actually rouse themselves out of bed this early. I have a confession to make, which is that I came to this workshop primarily for the purpose of heckling my colleagues. Unfortunately, something went wrong, and I'm standing up here. So I want to show that I can take it as well as dish it out. So this is going to be an open quantum seminar, which is to say I want to interact with my environment. Paul told me at sometime around 3 p.m. yesterday that I was giving a talk this morning. So I went home and I sort of slammed together a bunch of transparencies. And as a result, this is the outline, essentially, of a talk. So if you ask lots of questions and interrupt me and argue with me and disagree and tell me that I'm a complete idiot, then we will probably have a nice 60-minute seminar and then we can all go for coffee. If you don't, then we'll have a nice half-hour seminar and the coffee will be ready. In other words, please ask questions. I do reserve the right to cut off any given line of inquiry if it goes for way too long, but please do ask questions, because otherwise I will probably skip over, skim over the most interesting material. That said, what I'm going to talk about I'm going to talk about several things. The core idea here is I'm going to talk about how to get classicality out of quantum mechanics as an emergent phenomenon by focusing on a particular criterion, which is objectivity. And I'll talk more about exactly how I want to define objectivity later on. And the sort of pinnacle of the talk, maybe, although you can argue about that, is going to be something we call quantum Darwinism. And when I say we, most of what I'm going to, in fact, everything I'm going to talk about in here is joint work of myself and Wojciech Zorek. There are some other people who have been involved in the greater sphere of this project, David Poulin in particular, Otto Olivier. And if you look up our names on the archive, then you'll find a body of work on this. The papers that are relevant to what I'm going to be talking directly about are these ones, and I sort of put up little red citation marks throughout, just in case you see something interesting that you want to pursue further. If there's a quant pH number on a slide, then you know where to go. So I want to start out by introducing this idea of reality as an emergent phenomenon. Hopefully your ears are pricking up and maybe you're getting ready to fight and argue here, because that sounds like a really kind of a wacky thing. And in fact, I'll be completely upfront here. I've intentionally made a provocative talk. I'm going to try to skate right along the edge of crack pottery here. Okay, not quite. But I'm really going to push the envelope a little bit, because this is, I hope, an audience that is interested in seeing the envelope pushed. And as I move along through the talk, I'm going to get sort of slowly more standard. I'm going to talk about the environment as a witness approach. And essentially what this is a new way of looking at decoherence theory. We took decoherence theory, which people have been doing for the past 25 years, or arguably substantially longer. We really sort of turned it inside out. It's all the same physics, but it's answering a bunch of different questions. So at the risk of overusing the buzzword, it's a new paradigm. And then at the core, I want to argue that an information theoretic concept, redundancy, leads to a concept that's a little bit more philosophical, which is objectivity. And that this, in turn, constructs something that sounds really philosophical, but of tremendous interest to physicists, which is reality. And then I'm going to get a little bit less controversial. I'm just going to tell you about the tools of the trade, what we use mathematically and visually to analyze this new approach to decoherence theory. And then finally, I'm going to apply those tools of the trade really briefly and show you some results from numerical explorations of models of physical systems that I hope will convince you that we're onto something with this approach and that it might, in fact, have some vague claim to truth. Any questions so far?
What's the truth?
Oh, boy. I'm a positivist, so I don't actually believe in truth. So that's why I stuck that vague in there. So perhaps I should say it has some vague claim to truth. General relativity has a pretty good claim to truth, you know, but even that I'm not convinced is true. So if we're going to make a partial ordering of theories based on how convinced of them you should be, I'm not going to try to compete with general relativity. But I am going to try to come in somewhere above what the bleep. Okay, so The first half of my talk was written completely last night. And in particular, it came out of a nice, vigorous argument I had with a couple of my colleagues who will remain unnamed. And I want to try to present the foundations and the framework of this approach, where we're coming from, where we're going with it, and why you should buy it. So this is sort of an outline of the first half of my talk. First of all, I want to talk about operational classicality and how it fits in with decoherence theory. And the central idea here is I want to put reality into quantum mechanics, which we all acknowledge is not a realistic theory. But I want to do it inside out from the way that, for instance, hidden variables people have done it. I don't want to start with a realistic substrate and then stack some other things like epistemic restrictions on it to make quantum mechanics appear. Instead, I'm going to start by taking quantum mechanics completely seriously, which is a program that goes back at least to Everett, who is maybe the first high-profile person to take quantum mechanics completely seriously and try to, okay, there's history before that. High profile is a very subjective thing. There are those who would trace the use of quantum mechanics to deconstruct itself to Everett. Let's put it that way. But anyway, I'm going to take quantum mechanics seriously. And then I'm going to try to show how the very non-quantum classical world that we see around us can emerge from that. Then I want to verge as close as I'm going to do to philosophy here. I'm going to claim that reality is, in fact, something that can be constructed. That reality is in the eye of the beholder, and essentially, if you will, that the observer is, in a very rigorous sense, inevitably part of your theory. And that the constraints placed on the observer, in fact, produce what is, they constrain what is reality. And hopefully that will make a little bit more sense. And then I'm going to introduce this environment as a witness paradigm. And at the core, this is very simple. Observations, these quantum measurements that are such a theoretical pain in the butt, are not made directly on systems. We observe systems through their environment. Right now, you're all observing me. You're gaining information about me. You have formed some mental image of me and what I'm saying. And not one of you is directly interacting with me. What you're interacting with is an electromagnetic field and a density field of the air around me, and excitations are propagating through that field, and they're getting to you, and you are concluding things about me. The fascinating thing is that every one of you is, I hope, concluding roughly exactly the same things. None of you has concluded that I'm jumping up and down on one leg and hooting like a bird. So somehow, all of these various observers here have come to the same conclusion, which is an interesting phenomenon. And we claim that we can explain this by focusing on a single fact, that measurements are indirect through the environment, and that's what provides a resource to measure a system. So then I'm going to come back and I'm going to readdress this reality is in the eye of the beholder thing. What I'm going to start by doing is I'm actually going to address a very old problem. And this is not earth-shaking or new, but it's something that I think is insufficiently appreciated. So I'm going to take advantage of the opportunity to talk about it. There are these statements in old papers that say a decohering system will always be, quote, found, unquote, in one of its pointer-based states. And I'll explain briefly what that means if you're not familiar with terminology. And I'm going to show why that seems, at first blush, it can't be true. But then I'm going to explain in what sense it is true. And that lays the foundation for this idea of reality as something that's emergent. So then I'm going to come back to this a little bit later on. I'm going to use this environment as a witness paradigm, which is relatively new, to the same goal. I'm going to show why some of a system's properties are, in fact, a quantum system's properties, are, in fact, objective, and why the rest of them effectively don't exist. And this is the sense in which I mean that reality is constructed, that it consists of these properties that are made objective, not by any action of the observer, but by the interaction with the larger environment. And then I'm going to introduce this idea of quantum Darwinism, which quite simply is the process by which certain properties of a quantum system get selected out from all of the others and propagated out into the environment so that lots and lots and lots of observers all agree on those properties. And this happens at the expense of other information. which becomes completely inaccessible to those observers, and they can't even have an opinion on it if they're rational critics. So that was my highly extended introduction, a good place to pause for questions and breakbacks if there are any. Yes?
If by reality you actually mean the classical world around us, is that what you mean?
Roughly, yes.
So then the terminology seems self-defeating, because if this is your program, then you will prove that reality is observer-dependent and hence not real. Is that fair to say? Or?
I will prove that reality is observer-dependent is not real? No, that actually... So there's a great deal of philosophical slipperiness here. And I'm not going to claim to have resolved it all, but let me focus on that part. I'll claim, no, that's not the case. I'm going to define reality as precisely that which is effectively objective. It is not dependent on which observer. All observers end up agreeing about everything that they can observe. Let me take a stab at this. What I mean by reality is the set of things that can be observed. The things that cannot be observed don't exist to a scientist. If they are completely theoretically unobservable, then it's like the question of, you know, presuming that God is unobservable, the question of whether God exists or not is not a scientific question. So I'm going to define reality to be that which is observable, and then I'm going to show that that which is observable we also agree on. It's objective.
Yeah, I think this is exactly what Bohr says. He identified the objective world with the classical world. And it said precisely what you say, namely that the quantum world does not exist.
I think this work is definitely in the philosophical spirit of Bohr, but we have taken it to a new level of mathematical rigor. Bohr proposed this idea. I'm not aware that Bohr actually addressed it in specific physical models or provided a paradigm to do so.
But Ludwig would say exactly the same, fulfilling Bohr's vision at a new level of mathematical rigor. But it's entirely different from that.
And so, it's not full effort set either. I think that the effort line is kind of against the Bohr's vision. And you seem to want to have it all. Right.
Well, of course. So the approach that I'm going to take here is what I would call weak many worlds. And Everett, of course, you know, introduced this many worlds idea. I don't take many worlds literally. But I do take the idea of the universe evolving unitarily and being, in some sense, describable by a pure state vector, literally. And then the point is to say what happened. Let's analyze what we actually see in that case. And what I'm going to argue is that what we actually see, given this taking unitarity seriously, what we see is completely, what the theory predicts that we see is completely consistent with what we do see. So I think it's fair to say that the point of this is to reconcile Everett with Bohr. That Bohr's view of, yes, there's a classical world, actually comes out of taking the wave function literally. That many worlds, i.e. the literal interpretation of unitary dynamics, seems like it would lead to all sorts of contradictions. But if you stare at the role that observations play, then it turns out not to be a contradiction. And you may say I'm wrong, but at least I've had a chance to state what it is that I'm trying to say. So shall I proceed, and then you can shred me later on?
Okay. Yeah, but I think one of Bohr's greatest insights was the identification of the objective with the classical. Did you adopt the desired sports?
So I am not as familiar with the old literature as I should be, and I will just state that up front. Would you say that Bohr identifies the objective with the classical, or the classical with the objective? Okay. The point here is I'm saying, let's ask, what is objective? And then that is what we're going to define as classical, and we find from doing the math that that agrees with what is normally thought to be classical.
Yeah, so it's a theorem in your case, because in this case it's a principle.
I think that's fairly accurate, but we could get very deep into to confusion here. So, moving on. Okay, basically the operational classicality, this is a conference on operational theories and the quantum classical transition. So, what is operational classicality? Well, what problem does it solve? The problem here, I think, is painstakingly familiar to everybody, is that quantum theory is not equal to classical theory. And there's a bunch of differences, just pulling some out of a hat that seem relevant here. We've got this distinction in quantum theory between epistemic and ontic states. Seems like what you can know and what the theory seems to say can exist are different. We have this problem where measurements disturb the system, and throughout the foundations of classical physics and theory, we like to believe that we can sort of stand outside the system and measure things without disturbing them. You can't duplicate information, and there's a no-cloning theorem standing in the way. You can only duplicate certain information, et cetera, et cetera. The core problem, as far as I can tell, is that quantum mechanics is not a realistic theory. Now, I'm far from being an expert on exactly what a realistic theory is, but some of my colleagues have told me that I won't go too wrong by saying a realistic theory is one that has a hidden variable classical structure underlying it, or at least, you know, in it. So this really bothers some people. Again, names will remain unspecified. This leads to these hidden variable theories and other things as a way of resolving this tension. And I think the goal of hidden variable theory is to show that you can start with some realistic substrate. The universe could be realistic. And then you can do something to that to make quantum mechanics come out of it. The proposal is certainly not always that this is the way it is, but the goal is to see whether this could happen. So my goal is to turn it completely around the other way. I want to see whether this realistic behavior can actually emerge from a quantum substrate self-consistently. And so that's what I'm going to call operational classicality. The theory itself is not in any sense classical. The theory is going to be quantum mechanics. Essentially, does quantum mechanics, when you allow it to operate with realistic Hamiltonians, look classical? One of the tools that's been used to address this is decoherence theory. So here is the incredibly brief whirlwind tour of decoherence theory. I've skipped a lot of stuff, and I'm pretty much going to assume that everybody knows this. So if you don't, please stop me and ask questions. Decoherence is sort of a two-headed thing. On one hand, it helps us, we hope, to understand the classical world or why quantum systems behave classically. On the other hand, it's the major obstacle to quantum information processing. Just trot down the street to the Institute for Quantum Computing and you'll hear them swearing at decoherence all day long. So, depending on which perspective you come from, this can be either good or bad. It's, at the core, a very simple idea about which at least hundreds, probably thousands of papers have been written, which is the system that you're interested in interacts with its environment. It's an open quantum system. And so instead of unitary evolution of a density matrix, where you just sandwich a thing between you and you dagger, you first add on an environment, the state of an environment, then you evolve the entire thing according to a joint Hamiltonian, and then you trace the environment back out again at the end. There's other approaches, approximations to this, but this is what we believe is fundamentally going on. What you get instead of unitary dynamics are non-unitary dynamics. So here's the toy picture that I like to put up. This is a block sphere consisting of all the possible pure states for a spin. And when you put the block sphere, where you put a system of a spin 1/2 through a decoherence process, what comes out is some reduced manifold of states. All of these states have gotten squashed down on from the block sphere to what you might call the block spindle, which is a set of mixtures of these two pointer states, which are defined as being the states that are robust to decoherence. In other words, up and down didn't actually change through this process, whereas left, right, in, out, the eigenstates of sigma x and sigma y got transformed into probabilistic mixtures of those pointer states. Yes?
What happens when the environment, so you assume that it's separable, you know, what happens when you're entangled with the environment?
Initially entangled? Well, interesting question. All hell breaks loose. It was one answer. The technical answer is the dynamics are no longer completely positive, but a better answer is that we violated one of the assumptions that we started with, which is that all initial states of the system can exist. So the people study these non-completely positive maps by postulating initial correlation between the system and its environment. But if that correlation is entanglement, definitely, and arguably if there's any correlation, then I do not have a dynamical map whose domain is all the pure states of the system. And the reason is that there does not exist a set of entangled states between the system and the environment where each one of them has as its reduced density matrix on the system one of these pure states. For instance, if I start with the maximally entangled state, then that implies that the state of the system has to be the maximally mixed state. So what I have then is a dynamical map on the maximally mixed state, not a dynamical map on a spin 1/2 particle. So the long answer is things get very complicated and it's not clear how well defined stuff is. There are fairly good reasons for always making the assumption that the system and the environment start uncorrelated. And one of them is that if we're coming at this from an operational perspective, then we start with a preparation, and then we let it evolve, and then we make a measurement. If you have a good preparation procedure, then it will, in fact, prepare the system in a state that is not correlated with the environment. You might imagine just making a projective measurement to find out what the initial state is. Otherwise, you don't know what it is, right? You have to know what it is in order to see where it should go. If you make that projective measurement, you collapse it into a pure state, which cannot be entangled with the environment. Did I mostly answer? Okay. So I was just arguing that there's typically a pointer basis, a set of orthogonal, not necessarily a complete basis, the set of orthogonal states, which are not necessarily a complete basis, which are robust to decoherence. This is not necessary. In some cases, for some processes, there isn't a pointer basis. For instance, the dephasing channel on a single spin 1/2 just takes everything to the maximally mixed state. So that's something good to keep in mind. Okay. So now let me address this old problem that I mentioned. Let me take you way back about 25 years to 1981, and this paper by Wojciech Zurek in PhysRevT, which I've read through a couple of times. And for quite a while, I was getting stuck on this sentence on the first page. And it says, we argue that the apparatus cannot be observed in the superposition of the pointer basis states because the state vector is being continuously collapsed. I'm not entirely comfortable with the phrase, because the state vector is being continuously collapsed. But that's because I like things that have a rigorous interpretation, and I'm not convinced that collapse actually happens. In a way, it's sort of antithetical to the whole using quantum mechanics to investigate itself procedure, because we'd like to not stick in a collapse postulate. But maybe if we put quotes around collapse, I'd feel better about it. But the part that really bothers me is the statement the apparatus can't be observed at the superposition of pointer basis states. If I've got one of these decoherence processes that collapses me into a pointer basis, fine. So it's collapsed. Okay. Oh, sorry. I shouldn't use the word collapse there. So it has been decohered or reduced into a pointer basis or a mixture thereof. Fine. What's to stop me from going ahead and measuring some other basis, right? Sigma z is the pointer observable. This is the spin. I have a Stern-Gerlach apparatus. I'm just going to cram that spin through my Stern-Gerlach apparatus, turn 90 degrees on its side, and I'm darn well going to measure sigma x. Who can get in my way? And back in quantum mechanics 101, I learned that when you measure an observable, you get one of the outcomes of one corresponding to one of the eigenstates of that observable, and in fact, experiments bear this out. And I also learned that there's a thing called the Luders rule that tells you that once you've observed it, you collapse the state into that eigenstate. So haven't I observed a state, one of the eigenstates of sigma x, one or the other, that is a superposition of the pointer bases? Now, you could argue that decoherence disrupts this process, but the thing is, measurements are usually thought to happen on roughly the same time scale as decoherence. They're both stemming from the same phenomenon. So I just make a really big, high-energy apparatus, and I measure that thing really, really fast. Click happens instantaneously. So what's going on? Well, the answer is there is something more subtle going on here, and this is at the core of my argument that reality can emerge. So what's wrong with the procedure that I just said? What's wrong with it is that I thought I was doing a measurement, but I would argue that I wasn't actually measuring anything. Here's why. If I am claiming to make a measurement, to make an observation, then as a scientist, I ought to verify that I have done so. I shouldn't just take it on faith. So how would I verify? Well, we're all at least, you know, semi-friendly with operationalism. So here's how you verify an operation or an observation. First, you prepare a test state. And you're going to do this over and over again, of course. I think both Rob and Matt are covered, and John. This was covered yesterday, so I'm going to skim straight through it. I'm going to make a preparation. For instance, I prepare an eigenstate of the thing that I want to measure. Then I'm going to make a measurement. And when I analyze the results, I should always get this result, or maybe there's some noise. So the statistics should show me that there is correlation between the test state and the outcome of the measurement. But what if I stick decoherence in the middle here? We say that this is constantly happening to the system of interest. So step 1.5, my system gets decoherent very rapidly. Maybe not faster than I can make a measurement, but probably faster than I can switch from preparation mode to measurement mode. So what happens? I prepare this state. Then it gets decoherent, which means that really I've prepared a completely random state. And now I make a measurement, and I randomly get the left or the right outcome. And what do I conclude by analyzing the results of my test of my measurement? I conclude that this entire black box apparatus was completely indistinguishable from a coin flip. And now I'm going to apply Occam's razor and say, well, if it's indistinguishable from a coin flip, then it is a coin flip. I didn't make a measurement because I can't prove that I made a measurement. Unless you want to take it on faith that my apparatus actually exists, but I can't verify it, I can't test it. So the point is, if I have a system that is decohering rapidly enough in a particular basis, I can't actually build an apparatus that measures it, that observes it in some other basis. I can build one that I think does, but I can never observe it, and so we should throw that out of science, because science is built on verifiable things, not on things that you just say, well, you know, I believe that this works. Okay, now, this is the point at which a lot of technical objections could be raised based on, well, we know things about physical theory, and you build your Stern-Gerlach, and you show that it works in the Z basis, and then you rotate it 90 degrees, and you have faith that, you know, the Lorentz transformations don't fundamentally change the physics, etc. But the point that I want to make is, if you can't observe something, then really it shouldn't exist. You shouldn't say that it exists, because you can't be sure that it exists. So it's only a measurement if I can prove that I did a measurement. If it looks like noise, then it is noise. So the implication of this chain of thought is, in fact, a decohering system is never actually observed in a non-pointer basic state. You might think you did, but you can't prove it to a skeptical observer. This is my criteria. You should be able to prove that you did what you did to a skeptical observer. Let me take that a little bit further. For an open quantum system that decoheres, non-pointer observables, ones that don't commute pointer basis, don't exist. I'm sort of trying to be provocative here, and maybe if people haven't had enough coffee, I was expecting, you know, pounding on the table. The general argument is, well, you just can't measure them, or they are noisy, or they're disrupted. But I want to take that further. I want to say, if they are that noisy that you can never measure them, then they don't exist. They're not part of reality. So what this does is it says dynamics can constrain, quote, reality. If I define reality as being that which I can observe, and it should be obvious by now that I'm a fairly hardcore positivist, then this question of what are the dynamics of the quantum world is sort of interesting.
So how can you be sure that in 50 years' time you won't be disproved by clever experimentalists?
This has already happened, right? If somebody comes along and shows that they can observe some observable, which I couldn't observe before, then that becomes part of my reality. It becomes realistic. So there is a degree to which our, well, more than a degree, to which what we can do defines what, as a positivist, I'm willing to call reality. But it's the obvious conclusion is, well, that's tremendously, you know, subjective, right? But I'd argue it's not. It's not precisely subjective, because once the, and I'll try to reinforce this in a minute, if it becomes possible to engineer the universe so that something is observable, then you've also, and that's essentially what we do by improving our measurement technology. We protect a system from its normal interaction with the environment, put it in a really good Faraday cage, and then we engineer another interaction which propagates information about the thing that we want to measure into that environment. Once we've done that, we have in fact changed what is realistic about that system. But what I'm going to argue in just a minute is that even though we can, by altering the universe, by changing the interaction, we can change what is realistic, we can't change the structure of the realistic things. There's no way, for instance, that we can make X and P simultaneously observable, but we can, in fact, choose which one of them will be realistic. Okay. Yes? Absolutely.
Is it the case that it has to be possible to make predictions? So if, suppose I measure sigma X, and then I measure sigma X again more rapidly than decoherence time, and I have predictability, mm-hmm. then you would say, okay, sigma X exists. But if I don't do that second measurement, you would say sigma X doesn't exist. It just seems
I would say you haven't proven that it exists.
So, but in all the standard situations wherein we do preparations of systems that are well isolated from their environments, and we go around talking about, you know, the properties that exist, what would you say about this? You'd say, well, we're well justified in thinking that those properties exist because we know of measurements that could, in principle, verify it, although we're not doing them. The counterfactual possibility of doing a measurement,
right.
That would...
I'm not entirely comfortable with the phrase "in principle," and the reason is that there are two different ways to interpret "in principle." One of them is, if I were to actually take this measurement apparatus that I have sitting around in my laboratory right now and bring it over here and make the measurement, or the equivalent. The other is, if I had access to all the energy in the universe to build a perfectly coherent gravitational wave detector, then I could measure this, right? Somewhere in between, we cross the line from it exists realistically, and we can talk about it, and we can state logical propositions, to no, it really doesn't. So this is not a sharp notion. As Paul has pointed out, it's possible to change what exists objectively, and as I think you just pointed out, there is a fuzzy line. There's, you know, I can say, look, these things clearly exist. These things effectively don't exist because it would take more energy than there is in the universe to actually observe them. But there's a continuum. Well, I don't know where to draw that line. I don't think it's well defined where to draw that line. So maybe one way of looking at it is, I'm not claiming to exercise all the demons of quantum mechanics by any means. There is still a weird boundary zone going on. Have I answered it appropriately? Okay. Yes?
I think this is probably related to the previous question. My impression is that it's dangerous to base this interpretation on the similarity between the decoherence time and the time for the measurement, because this might vary much in different situations. And so sometimes the system might be decohered, and then you, of course, your conclusion is correct, But it might be that the decoherence was not complete.
Yep.
And why I think there's no sharp distinction between these two cases. And so to use it as a principle that certain things don't exist seems to be very dangerous.
Okay. I pretty much fully agree. And I think actually you connected Rob's concern that, you know, how is it clear which things I'm going to say have existence, and Paul's concern that we can actually, you know, changes in technology, changes in the whim of somebody who's operating the apparatus can change this. What I would say to that is absolutely, and look, we look at experiments that are going on right now. We live in a world that either is quantum fundamentally, or certainly shows a heck of a lot of quantum phenomena, right? I mean, people are factoring 15. People are creating entangled states of 8 ions. Well, okay, factoring. Stop that. The point is, quantum mechanics is real. So if anybody is going to stand up here and say, aha, I have solved the problem, look, the universe is really all classical and we're never going to see any quantum phenomena, no, I mean, that's not the case. There is clearly a regime where we see exceedingly quantum phenomena. The question that I guess I want to resolve is, why is it that there's this gigantic regime in which we don't see any quantum phenomena? And should we feel comfortable about the fact that you and I are talking and not noticing any, you know, quantum phenomena? Contextuality is not really relevant in giving a seminar, well, except in the abstract. Does that make sense? Or do we, as some people claim, need to add something to quantum mechanics? Is quantum mechanics insufficient? So, to some degree, this is the goal here is to show consistency, to show that we experience something that's reality, and pretty much all of the things that we, on an everyday basis, experience as reality can be understood as coming from a quantum framework. But if we poke down enough, then if your measurement time is longer than the decoherence time, then we're going to be in one regime. If it's much shorter, we're going to be in another regime. So you can cross over that boundary. Yeah?
Would you say that in order for a quantum computer to operate, it cannot be real?
Basically, yes. At least, well, I would say it cannot be realistic. And that, I think, is not terribly controversial. And I would hate to be quoted by certain physicists out there as saying it can't be real. But a better way of saying it is that it has to have a substantial subsystem that is not an element of reality, or that does not have any elements of reality. And in fact, I'll make a comment that sort of says this explicitly. You just make it here. So yeah, I think that's actually a very good and provocative way of putting it. Okay, so let me sort of coast in. I've gotten past the most controversial stuff. So I hope that even if you don't agree with everything that I've said, in fact, even if you think I'm completely off my rocker with everything I've said so far, I hope that as I come back into more grounded stuff, you'll follow with me. Environment is a witness paradigm. So I talked about decoherence. I tried to resolve this weird-sounding statement about decoherence. Now, let's reformulate decoherence. There's limitations. Limitations of decoherence. First of all, measurement is still sort of a deus ex machina. It comes in from the outside. You say, well, yes, decoherence affects the system, but then I have tremendous power to bring in my measuring apparatus and make a measurement. We don't really understand what making a measurement is. We've got the von Neumann chain, but it's unsettling away. The other thing that bothers me about the decoherence paradigm is that classical reality is essentially what's left after decoherence takes the quantum world and it sort of strips out a bunch of stuff. So you get the impression of classical reality as being like the crack that's left in the bottom of your coffee cup after you've drunk the coffee. It's what's left. And there's a question of, well, where did it come from anyway? So one of the points of this, of the different paradigm is to look at where the realistic things, the objective things, actually come from, not just how they appear as what's left after you drain away the confusion. And we still have a problem with information disturbance, right? If my system, my spin, if my spin decoheres, and I then measure the pointer basis, well, fine. I get a predictable result. But suppose that David comes along in between, and he makes this measurement of sigma x. Then he won't get any information. He can't prove that he's done a measurement, but he certainly can disturb the system. And he wasn't trying to disturb it. He was just trying to make a measurement. So we haven't exercised the measurement disturbance problem at all. Okay. We're planning there. Okay. The way that we claim to resolve this is by simply observing that measurements are not direct, as I pointed out before. This is going to be sort of an axiom. Thou shalt not make direct measurements. And in practice, if you think about actual measurement procedures, we virtually never interact directly with the system of interest. We scatter photons off of it. We detect radiation coming away from it. We do something that causes it to interact with its environment, which amplifies the signal in some way. And then we go and we glean the signal out of the environment. The second key observation is that we don't capture the entire environment. We capture a little tiny bit of the environment. Here's a fun thing. See if you can calculate in your head what fraction of the electromagnetic field that is surrounding me and carrying information about what I look like or my talk are you actually capturing? It's staggeringly small. Richard Dawkins has this interesting bit in one of his recent books where he talks about the 10,000-mile burqa or something like that. And he's trying to be provocative, but his point is that we human beings look at the world through an incredibly narrow slit in the electromagnetic spectrum. We're sensitive between 400 and 700 nanometers. There's a lot more out there, and I'm radiating and reflecting in all of it. So, and not only that, but you're capturing an infinitesimally small fraction of the 4π radiance around me. So how is it that without interacting with me directly and without capturing, you know, more than 10 to the minus 8 of my environment, you're getting any kind of reliable information about me? The other point is that because you're capturing such a tiny fragment, there are lots of other fragments that are available to other observers. So these are the three core points behind the environment as a witness paradigm. Then we want to say, okay, what can we actually observe? If you can't observe it, if no one can observe it, then I don't want to postulate it as being realistic. It's essentially invisible. And so the question that we ask here is, how does information about my central system that I'm interested in flow through the environment and get to the observers, us, who are building science, right? At the end of the day, we are the people who form theories. If it doesn't get to us, then we don't know about it, and it's not going to be part of our theory. So what are the consequences of this? First of all, what can I observe? Well, I can only capture a tiny fragment of the environment. And what this means, first of all, is the only things that I can reliably observe are the things that many other people can reliably observe as well. I would have to work incredibly hard to get some sort of privileged access to the environment that a putative other observer couldn't also get. If I want to observe my coffee cup and get something that's not redundant in the environment, then I would have to build some sort of photodetector that encompassed the entire 4π around it and had 100% efficiency absolutely everywhere. Otherwise, I wouldn't be capturing the entire environment. So this is why I'm going to say that that which we observe is, in fact, precisely that which can be objective, because it is shared among a tremendous and essentially infinitely extensible number of observers. By the way, I forgot to note this before. Apologies to one of my colleagues in particular. When I say objective, those of you who have thought deeply about this may want to substitute the word intersubjective. I am going to take something that is arbitrarily, extensibly intersubjective, which is to say something on which any arbitrary, finite number of observers could and must agree. That's my definition of objective, basically because I'm a positivist. Okay, so sufficiently redundant records are objective. Why? First of all, the same information is observable to, is obtainable by a whole bunch of people. So we can all get it, we'll all agree on it. And the second thing that's really cool is one measurement doesn't disturb any of the others. Why? Because Lucien is measuring one particular chunk of the electromagnetic field, and Monro is measuring another chunk, and there's no signal. If one of you guys collapses that in some particular basis, it doesn't affect the subsystem that goes to somebody else. The only way that you can actually disturb somebody else's measurement is by really getting in there and directly interacting with the system. So I'm not trying to say that measurement, that information that disturbance doesn't happen. We know that it does happen. But in any situation where you have an open system that's interacting with its environment and is spamming redundant records out there, then it certainly doesn't have to appear to happen. There is a very large, big, inviting loophole around information disturbance. So this is basically the framework for my argument that the things that are redundant are the things that are objective. Those are also the things that are real. It's objective if it's redundant, because, first of all, if it's redundant, then many people can get it, and second of all, we can't interfere with each other's observations. And it's real, or realistic, if you will, if it's objective. Because, as I've argued up here, nobody can observe the things that aren't redundant, because the criterion for one person being able to observe it is essentially the same as the criteria for many people being able to observe it. Okay, yes?
This is about information gain disturbance. I thought you were going to say that because the observers are sampling the environment, the information gain disturbance has already happened when the environment interacted with the system.
That's
the environment that chose what observable was going to be measured.
Yep.
And the disturbance occurred, and so it's already occurred.
I think that is a completely valid perspective on it. The fact that it has already occurred means that when you make a measurement, you don't disturb it. Because the only things that you can actually, well, actually, this is interesting. Not only do you not disturb it when you make a measurement, but remember my example back before when I said, well, I've got this single spin in the decoherence paradigm. I can't observe sigma x because it got decohered. But David could come in and do something that he could try to measure sigma x, and he would fail. But he would disturb my measurement of sigma z. Here, you can't even do that. So even if you make something that I would, as a positivist, not call a measurement because it's, it looks like a coin flip, you still can't disturb my information. So that's the reason I focused on saying your measurement doesn't make a disturbance, but your paradigm is completely correct. Yes?
You computed that the closed system has a text. On the other hand, you started in your measurement with the idea that the system you are going to measure is independent of the environment, which is almost different with the idea of a closed system. So did it exist before you started with it?
Well, that's an interesting point that I'm going to try to answer it completely off the cuff. To say that a system is uncorrelated with its environment is not the same as to say that it is closed.
How do you define your closed system?
A closed system is one which does not interact with its environment. So it's a dynamical statement. So I can have a system that is uncorrelated with its environment. For instance, one way is that I have a spin which undergoes a constant decoherence process in the z basis. Now, if I somehow prepare that system in an eigenstate of sigma z, it is still very much an open system. It is interacting with its environment, but it will not become correlated.
For me, a closed system is a system which is not dynamically coupled with any other system, and which is probabilistically independent. And if you have a completely positive evolution, and it is not probabilistic, it almost follows a then.
I'm sorry, I missed the last bit.
So
it almost follows that?
That it is a closed system in the sense that it is not dynamically, neither dynamically nor probabilistically connected with any other system.
When you say probabilistically connected, do you essentially mean that they're correlated states? Right. That sounds reasonable, but I'm afraid I've lost track of what the question was.
The question from the beginning is that you seem to conclude that closed systems do not exist. And in your measurement scheme, you obviously started with an idea that the system you're going to measure is independent of
but
the environment.
I think the best
almost the same
by closed I mean only dynamically closed here.
It doesn't mean it's decoupled, right? Because if you prepare it in a Z eigenstate and decoherence is in the Z basis, it's an open system, but it's decoupled from the environment. So, I mean, decoherence is, that's a strange way of saying it, but it's a way to decouple, right? I mean, you let the system interact with its environment, and then you measure its environment, and all of a sudden it becomes decoupled.
I want to say that your closed system, you define the closed system only in terms of the dynamics, so that there's no interaction with anything.
Yes. Okay, a system
so
that does not interact with anything else is invisible. Pardon me?
Then this notion of closed system is different, but I am accustomed to use.
Okay.
Okay.
Sorry about the. I think some notation confusion was inevitable in this. Yes.
But I think then you get a problem because you consider the system together with its environment as a closed system.
So
this will not exist according to the.
So here is where I'm going to fall back on faith-based physics, and I'm going to postulate that there exists a closed system, which I'm going to call the universe. And what I think is that within that, I have a system that is coupled to its environment, and the environment is coupled to a larger environment, and it's the onion model of the universe, right? Everything is connected to its surroundings. Now, if I have time, I'm going to zip through some numerical studies here, in which we do in fact analyze a relatively small closed system consisting of a central system and an environment, and that is not coupled to anything else. And the only reason we do that is because we have finite sized computers. I think that eventually everything is effectively coupled to everything else. There might actually be things, subsystems, that are completely decoupled from all of their surroundings. And those, I mean, they might exist. They also might not exist. They're. I can't say anything about them because I can't see them, right? But I do think that so there's nowhere in here that I'm going to insist that that I close at some point. I think it keeps going.
If you go that way, take the whole universe, haven't you lost Occam's razor along the way?
Haven't I lost what?
Occam's razor along the way.
Oh my. That's a fascinating question, but because I need to ask you what you mean, I can't actually answer it in the 4 minutes that I have left here.
You take additional assumptions, ideas, but which obviously cannot be proven operationally.
Can I just defer that until I would please bring it up again, but I don't want to get into it now. Yes.
Do you think some of the issues that have been raised could be resolved if you say something less provocative, like system can exist, you know, but maybe some of their properties do not exist. So for instance, you know, the environment exists, but maybe it doesn't have any properties until you measure it. There's a distinction, or maybe some of its properties. For instance, you know, the environment has a mass, okay, but maybe it doesn't have a well-defined, polarization or things like that. So,
and actually, mass is a great example. Everything that has mass interacts with everything else that has mass. So, if you think of the mass degree of freedom of a system as a sort of a subsystem, that degree of freedom, that can never be closed. It always interacts with everything else. So a system that has mass is necessarily not a closed system because it does interact with its environment. But as David points out, I can have a particle that has both mass and angular momentum. And if the angular, if so, that has two subsystems in a way, the mass subsystem and the angular momentum subsystem. And if the angular momentum subsystem doesn't interact with anything, then I would say it's not realistic. It doesn't exist because I can't see
but
it.
But the system stands.
But the mass particle subsystem, the particle still exists because its mass interacts for the things. Okay. So let me actually table discussion there. This is fascinating, but we do have a coffee break. So we've discussed that. Let me conclude the first half of my talk, and then I've got 2 minutes left to do the second half of my talk, which is okay because this was the cool bit. So we need a name for this spreading of information throughout the environment. Observe that some properties get spanned all over the environment, and we can then actually read them out. But not all properties can get redundantly mapped all over the place. So somehow, a decision has to be made, not by me necessarily, but somehow we have to decide which properties of a system get spanned, which axis of angular momentum is actually going to get propagated. Or perhaps none, but at most one, because of the no-cloning theorem. So what we say is the environment, or the interaction Hamiltonian and the Hamiltonian of the environment together, select some particular observable, somehow or other, that's going to get propagated all over the place, that's going to become redundant, objective, realistic. We also observe that complementary observables, and I could write this up on the board, a short proof of this, but I'm just going to ask you to take my faith for the moment. The complementary observables get not just not propagated, they're actually incredibly difficult to observe. If one observable, say sigma z, is all over the place, then sigma x can only be measured, i.e. you can only infer information about its initial value by capturing the whole environment. I don't mean all but one of the subsystems of the environment. I mean absolutely the entire environment. If you lose anything, you're kaput. So really, these complementary observables get thoroughly whacked at the expense of the ones that are propagated all over the place. And so, tooting the horns here, what we call this was quantum Darwinism, or sort of an analogy to natural selection. Because the point is that the selection here is not being done by the observer. It's being done somehow by the medium that selects certain information. It's not a conscious process or anything. It's not intelligent design. It's just that somehow some information ends up getting selected out and propagated all over the place. The other information is completely suppressed so that it's really, really difficult to get, practically impossible. So quantum Darwinism is the process by which one of these properties gets propagated at the expense of the ones that don't commute with it. Just as decoherence is the process by which certain observables of the system are made difficult to measure directly. Okay. Mr. Chair, should I take 5 minutes to sort of survey the fact that we've actually done some work on this, or would you like me to conclude now?
No, there have been many questions for me.
Okay. So let me, instead of boring you with detailed numerics here, let me just give you a basic idea of the toolkit that we actually use to go ahead and start doing some research on this. This is the environmental witness toolkit. Here's the familiar decoherence paradigm. Your universe consists of a system and an environment. Now we're going to chop off this environment into a whole bunch of little sub-environments. You might think of these as individual modes of the electromagnetic field. They might be individual spins in a bath of spins. And then the core question we're going to ask is, what information, how much information, does a particular little block of the environment provide? Because this division is special. We're going to divide it up according to its locality structure. It can be some sort of a tensor product structure that reflects how systems actually interact, not just some arbitrary tensor product structure, you know, pulled out of a hat. And so observers that are governed, that interact with things according to limited Hamiltonians, can usually only capture small fragments of this environment. So the idea is we want to break up the environment into fragments consisting of a relatively small number of atomic sub-environments, and then ask, how much information does each of these provide? Or more interestingly, how many of these fragments can we construct that provide sufficient information to reliably conclude things about the properties of the system? Tool that we've used through here for answering this question, it's a bit of a blunt instrument. It was something sort of grabbed because it was easy to compute, is the quantum mutual information between the system and a fragment or an individual sub-environment. It's, if you have a joint state, it's the entropy of one plus the entropy of the other minus their joint entropy. And it measures, it's a good measure of correlation. This entropy here is the von Neumann entropy. It should be pointed out that for those of you who are familiar with classical mutual information, the most mutual information you can have between two subsystems is the largest entropy of the two. So if you have two bits, then they can only have one bit of mutual information. Quantum mechanically, you can actually have two bits of mutual information, which roughly speaking represents non-classical correlations. It represents the ability to do steering in a quantum information sense. So we have a simple tool for understanding how information is stored in the environment. The idea is here, you start with an initial product state, you let this evolve according to some joint Hamiltonian, and then you analyze the resulting state, and you ask, what did this model do? How did it propagate correlations around? This tool is called a partial information plot, and it's very simple. We take this mutual information as a measure of how much information you can get from a fragment, and then we average over all fragments of a particular size. We plot the size of the fragment, starting from none of the environment to all of the environment on the independent axis, and then against that we plot how much information do you obtain on average by capturing such a fragment. This mutual information is an upper bound for how much you could actually learn by measuring it. And so the green line here is a typical profile for when information is redundant. You capture a small fragment of the environment, it gives you lots of information, and then capturing more of the environment really doesn't tell you very much because you just get more copies of the same thing. And then, at the very end, if you capture the entire environment, you get all of those quantum, those non-classical correlations that allow you to do steering and are interesting for quantum information purposes. There are other profiles that can exist. Information can, in fact, be distributed over the environment, where I take a book and I rip all the pages off and I put one on each chair, and you know, every time you capture a new page, you get new information. So that's this blue profile. And you can also have encoded information, where as you start to capture bits of the environment, you don't learn anything. And then at some point, it all kind of falls into place, and you get the puzzle piece that completes it, and you suddenly sort of get everything. There's a theorem that says that if you have a pure state of the joint system and environment, then there's always a reflection symmetry here. So these are really the three profiles that we've seen. Only one of them corresponds to redundantly encoded information. So the question we ask is, let's go out and look at models and see whether these models of decoherence actually lead to states that have redundant information storage, which is what we would expect from the fact that there does appear to be a classical world. So in a way, this gives you a way to challenge decoherence theory. If you've got a model, and it gives you these sorts of curves, then you say, this is not consistent with reality. This is a test that we didn't have a way to do before. Because you can have normal-looking decoherence on the system without actually getting the redundancy that we know has to exist. I think this will be almost my last slide. I'm going to skip quite a few here. This is a simple comparison. We took two different kinds of states. One of them, with the system, what we've got going on here is a central spin 1/2, which is the system of interest, and then a bunch of other spin 1/2s. And we started by looking at random states, just pulled them out of our measure and analyzed them. Said, what if the states of the universe were selected completely randomly from all the possible states? The answer is, with incredibly high probability, you get this encoded information. So that if I have a random state, and I ask how much does the environment tell me about the system of interest, the answer is, well, if I capture a small fragment of the environment, it tells me absolutely diddly squat. So not terribly surprising result is the universe is not described by random states. We are not, in fact, in thermal equilibrium. Thank goodness. However, we set up a very basic, simple model of decoherence, where the model starts with a superposition of pointer states. And then the environment effectively measures which pointer state we're in. And so we end up with a state, these are called singly branching states, where it's a superposition of the nth state on the system, the nth pointer basis state, tensored with a tensor product of environment states that are different. They're randomly selected pure states of the environment, but they're different for each pure state. So for each pure state, you say, okay, the first environment gets a randomly selected pure state, et cetera. The argument is, this is typical of models of decoherence, of simple models of decoherence, where you just have a sigma z interaction, for instance. And the short result is, we do in fact get this sort of redundant profile. I can tell you about other models that we have examined. I can tell you about the fact that, in fact, we do find that these models lead to redundancy and objectivity. And then I can tell you about the interesting things that happen, the role of dissipation, for instance, which eventually destroys those correlations. But that's all I'm going to tell you, because I think it's time for a coffee break. So let me skip on my summary. I think that pretty much states what I've said so far, but if you were sleeping during part of the talk, there you go. Thank you very much for listening.
System, we are not really talking about the system that goes to measure, but the point. In the sense that we just need the Bohr rule to get the state reduction as condition from the system. The problem is the Wigner-Fan problem. So we have the need of solving the Schrödinger cat problem, because we see this pointer objectively in a specific position. Everybody sees the same, right? So the idea is that there are objective measurements and subjective. Say, for example, I have two optical fibers, each one per eye going to the system, I see a result. This is not objective. It is not real. But everybody sees the pointer is there. This is the objective. Is here. So the point is that the environment should, if I understand, this is an idea that I was dwelling on it for a long time, couldn't find a solution. So the environment gives the same information to potentially infinite number of, but it distributes the information to a potentially unbounded number of observers. Right? There's a kind of huge cloner. And my solution is that quantum mechanics itself gives the solution. There is no cloning. So, and the best you can do is the optimal broadcasting. And the optimal broadcasting actually is indistinguishable with whichever measurement you do, because it's trace norm indistinguishable from a mixture of classical states, which is measuring the repeater. So the solution is that you want to have a result which is objective. The only way is to have an environment. Because the only way to distribute the same state to every potential observer, not, so if you have an unbounded, you want to solve the Wigner-Fan problem, right? So you have an unbounded number of potential observers, is to have a kind of cloning from one to infinite, which is almost indistinguishable. I'm saying it's a perfectly indistinguishable form, and going to infinite for a number from a classical state. Right? This is the old story?
I agree with everything you're saying. There's a couple of things that I want to point out, maybe. One is, you can attempt to clone the entire state, to do unbiased cloning, if you will. But if we're not aware of any models of decoherence in which the environment actually does that. Let me be a little provocative. I'm not trying to solve the Wigner's friend problem. I'm certainly trying to look at what actually happens, to do physics, and say, well, let's take these models, let's see what happens. And what comes out of them turns out to be something that looks like an attempt at solving Wigner's friend. So it's not so much, what I'm focusing on is not so much the what could be done if a particular interaction were engineered, but what do all of the interactions that actually exist in our universe look like? And there don't seem to be any that do optimal, unbiased broadcasting. What actually happens is that a particular basis gets selected out, and you get really good information about that one and not about the others. But other than that, I agree with everything you've said, that no cloning theorem says you can't set it up so that different observers are without,
But it must be a mechanism which is independent on, so objectivity should be independent on the specific environment.
No.
But some environments are just noise, right? They don't care information.
No, but I'm saying, suppose that, so we are in a world which, instead of getting information through this narrow band and the electromagnetic field, gets information from whatever, gamma ray, or don't think the objectivity will be true anyway, so.
It will certainly still be true.
We are in the sea underwater.
Sure. But you're still capturing, I mean, your eye, right?
Right.
Is incredible. The point is,
suppose we have everybody is blind and everybody is deaf, and we are just communicating by touching. There should be objectivity anyway, right? So there must be a universal mechanism which is pretty independent on the environment interaction.
I would say no, actually. And this should be a friendly, I'm going to argue and challenge you here in the interest of a friendly debate. But I would say that this is a phenomena that is going to happen no matter what environment you come up with. There are two possibilities. There are three possibilities. Possibility number one, an environment that propagates information out to many observers in the way that I have talked about. Possibility number two, an environment that doesn't propagate information at all. It interacts with the system, it decoheres the system maybe, but then it scrambles it. We get these encoded states and nobody learns anything about the system, in which case the system doesn't even exist until you come up with a way to engineer the environment so that it does propagate information. Possibility number three is an environment that doesn't interact with the system at all, and then it doesn't propagate any information about the system. And so in cases two and three, that particular system interacting with that environment is invisible and therefore doesn't exist within our science. So I claim that in fact, in every case in our experience, it is number one. The reason is there are no other possibilities except those two that don't allow us to even conclude that the system exists, right? I mean, we think 90% of the universe is dark matter. This is dark, closed systems, or ones whose environments don't propagate information about them, are kind of dark matter. We shouldn't be terribly surprised at this idea that maybe we're not observing the entire universe, right? Maybe there's lots of stuff out there that we're actually clueless about its existence. So it's not that I have to say all environments are like this. Instead, I can say there might be many systems and environments that are not like this, but we don't know about them.
Another possibility could be that by an anthropic principle, we start interacting without understanding anything. There is no classical world, there is no reality. And then after a long time, we establish some logical communication. And this is selecting only this specific environment which distributes the information.
I actually agree strongly with every part of that except labeling it with the anthropic principle, which makes me very itchy.
I should use another word. It's only to give the idea.
Yeah, but I agree with that, but I also feel that it's a fascinating argument that is tiptoeing right along the edge of that cliff that I talked about before, that one must be very careful when exploring that, because it's a fascinating and productive way to understand physics. But if you take one wrong step, then you're off the edge and people start doing this.
Metaphysics.
Yeah,
right. Now, last thing I want to say is that since you are really addressing the point, not the system, I want to stress that, because we just need the Born rule to have the state reduction as pure conditioning for the system. The problem is that then we don't know what is the end of the story for the point, and we need another experiment on the point, and then we get the bigger frame. So we want to establish some kind of objectivity for the point that have a kind of state and what we see in relation, or eigenstate, what we see in relation for the point.
The
pointer
like
should not be a closed system.
I would like
because things are interacting with the environment. We don't need to state that the point is a closed system.
I'd like to continue this offline. Because I think I would say that no, I'm actually talking about the system. When I say pointer states, those are.
Back to me, we cannot say that the speed is objective up. We just say that the position of the particle in the Stern-Gerlach experiment is objectively up, not the spin is up. We can say that. Nobody can see the spin.
I actually would say that yes, we can say that the spin is up, because the position is an environment for that. So there's two degrees of freedom. There's the position degree of freedom. There's the spin degree of freedom. And in as much as I can ever assign reality to anything, I would assign reality to the spin there, because I've observed it indirectly through a chain. The first element in the chain is the position, right? I've correlated the spin with the position. Then I correlated the position with the electromagnetic field. Then I correlated the photons with my eyeball, or right. So yes, I think I would say that that can gain objective reality. And in order to, I have to prove it. I have to show that I can do preparations and measurements, and then operationally there's correlation. But let's take this offline. Yes.
So I'm wondering, this claim that observers can't have high predictability about incompatible observables seems like the sort of thing it'd be nice to formalize it in a theorem. And so, essentially,
Rob, it has been. There's a paper by David and Adolphe Olivier and Wojciech. It's actually the first paper specifically on this business where they do exactly that.
So,
am I correct?
Yeah, we should.
You show a trade-off between, so what I was thinking, you have a trade-off.
The current statement is that if there is an observable about which you have all information, any other observable, the information that you get about those is the same that you would get by measuring that observable you know, and then just looking at the correlation with that. Meaning, you know, if you know perfectly about sigma z, then certainly, through the environment, you can learn about something that's tilted slightly away. Yeah. But it's the same that you would get by measuring sigma z in the inferior.
What about the scenarios where you don't have perfect information about sigma z?
Yes, so there we don't have general trade-off. We have in some model we've established a trade-off.
Yeah.
But we don't have it.
So there might be something in the literature that would be useful here, although I'm not sure. So I'm thinking you might have a trade-off between the variability of the kind of information that multiple observables have about the system and the amount of information they have. So if one observer knows sigma x and the other observer knows sigma y, that's possible, but they're going to know them badly.
Yes.
And it's not going to be a GC state, it's going to be a different kind of state.
Yeah.
But this is basically the same trade-off as they look at in monogamy and entanglement. The variability of the information is basically the quantumness of the correlation of the system, and the predictability is the strength of the correlation. So people have looked at trade-offs between how much quantumness many observers have in their correlations.
This is also tightly correlated with the approximate information preserving structures business that I'm working on. because in a way you can see the, if somebody has perfect knowledge about one thing, then they can't have any knowledge about something that doesn't commute with it except by the correlation between them. Mm-hmm. That follows from the algebra result in information observing structures. So the approximate version of that algebra theorem that we're trying to prove is, would address the question that you're asking. I think I saw a hand over here quite a while ago. That's all right.
Your notion of objectivity, in fact, was intersubjective.
What, pardon me? I was told last night that it's actually intersubjectivity.
Okay. Yeah.
But sort of infinitely extensible what intersubjectivity.
But let us assume that it is intersubjective. Then I would ask, to what extent your approach differs from the old London Noah solution of the measurement problem? Because actually there, the idea, it was an elaboration of von Neumann's idea that at the end, the observer can decide on his own state. And somehow this would fit pretty well here, that we all would agree what is our state with respect to the measurement result.
I would love it if you could give me the reference. I'm not familiar with the theory you've referenced. Okay, I've never gotten all the way through that one. I wish I could comment, but I can't. The only thing I'll say is I haven't claimed to solve the measurement problem. So there's a difference between me and anybody who does claim so.
Yes.
Than that one. Sorry.
As was just clarified, when you say objective, you really mean intersubjective agreement. So you seem to be equating intersubjective agreement with reality. The word reality is a funny word. Usually it sort of means something like what is.
Yep.
Something is real if it is, in some sense. But you're just saying reality is to do with intersubjective agreement. So can you say what do you mean by the word reality? Well, do you mean anything by the word reality that goes beyond just equating it with intersubjective agreement?
I am somewhat uncomfortable commenting here because I had never heard the word intersubjective until last night.
But just what do you mean by objective?
Well, okay, here's what I'm concerned about. Intersubjective, as far as I can tell, and please, anyone who's an expert, feel free to jump in and clarify my understanding, means a bunch of people agree.
Right.
This, I think, is somewhat stronger. It's not just that there is a set of people that agree. It's that every observer that could come to a conclusion, except for the insane ones who are starting with a really bad prior or are willing to jump to conclusions that they have no data for, et cetera, right? Every rational observer is going to do one of two things. They're either going to agree, even the ones that haven't done any observation yet, the ones that come in the future and make an observation, they will either agree with all of the ones who have already observed, or after making their measurement, they will conclude that they made the wrong measurement and didn't get any information.
Okay, so that's fine. So my real question is, what do you mean by the word reality? So do you mean anything by the word reality that goes beyond what you mean by the word objective or subjective? What do you use there?
Basically, no.
So reality just means objective or intersubjective, whatever word you're using in that context.
Yes.
Sorry?
It's the only possible.
No, because that meaning doesn't capture the usual meaning, which is that reality is what it is.
Did I mention I'm a positivist? What is what can be observed. I mean, I don't believe in a Platonic ideal here. So to me, part of the reason that I presented things the way I did is I've had long conversations with for instance, Rob and Howard Wiseman about realism. And I never understood really what it was that they were looking for in realism. And this to me is a sort of a resolution. I sort of thought about, you know, what could this mean? And to me, it's the unanimous vote of 10 to the 30th different subsystems. That is reality as far as I'm concerned. So I don't think there's an underlying.
There's still two different concepts. It's like saying, well, you know, if everyone votes for this being true, then it is true. But it being true is not the same as it's being voted to be true.
I'm saying, in my picture it is, let's say.
Okay, but that's...
And I would argue that this is defensible. And I need to sharpen these thoughts, but what else could be...
If it's due to laws of physics, I mean, not just subjective. It's like saying the interior of a black hole does not have physical properties. Maybe it does, but we're never going to find out. So maybe there's a fine line whether if everyone agrees based on subjective judgment, or everyone agrees due to physical laws. Maybe that's the distinction that he's...
Maybe here's an analogy. We talk about, you know, large macroscopic systems, jugs of liquids, as if they had a temperature. That really doesn't bother us. It's an incredibly effective theory. But we know that that's just an emergent property. It's sort of the average of 10 to the 22nd atoms' widely differing kinetic energies, right? We know that those atoms have widely differing kinetic energies. So what I'm saying here is that if you're at all comfortable with the idea of temperature, you should be, you know, as existing, then you should be even more comfortable with my idea of reality as being a firm foundation that's constructed, because it's not just the average vote of 10 to the 30th particles. It's the unanimous vote of 10 to the 30th particles. And to me, that's as solid as I could ever want for a foundation. And I don't have to posit the existence of an abstract reality if I see it as emergent this way and show, as I've tried to do, that it does emerge. But perhaps we can discuss it further.